And good morning and welcome to this January 17th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access those later in the hour. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. And for the first time in a few weeks, certainly the first time in 2018, we are finally diving back into fiction, which is always our first love. We are starting out with some very fun fiction at that. I'm with bestselling and prolific author Dean Koontz for the first half and debut novelist Patrick Nathan for the second with his book Some Hell. When he was a senior in college, Dean Koontz won the Atlantic Monthly Fiction Competition and has been writing ever since. His books are published in 38 languages. He has sold over 500 million copies to date, a figure that increases by more than 17 million copies per year. 14 of his novels have risen to the number one on the New York Times hardcover bestseller list, making him one of only a dozen writers to have achieved that milestone. 16 of his books have risen to number one position in paperback. His books have also been major bestsellers in countries as diverse as Japan and Sweden. Ricochet Joe came out last month. It's a Kindle in Motion book published by Amazon. So kind of best read if you have a Kindle Fire or a Kindle app on your iPhone. So there are a number of kind of animated graphic features that are incredibly inventive and fun. We're going to talk about that. Dean was born and raised in Pennsylvania, but he lives right here in our backyard in Southern California with his wife. Dean, huge pleasure. Welcome on.
Well, thanks for having me there.
I lost track of the number of books you've written, but I think it's north of 120 or something. As I'm reading this bio, I'm like, man, you must be tired.
It keeps me out of trouble with the cops if I stay productive. And somebody once said, how do you get all that done and keep up quality? And I said, well, Henry James wrote over 120 books in his life. So it's about whether you spend a lot of time at the keyboard or not. And I just love what I do. So that it's work, but it's pleasure. And if it's pleasure, you tend to be productive.
Yeah, that helps. Talk a little bit before we dive into Ricochet Joe about kind of generating that volume of ideas, and if one idea begets another, or if the books start to bleed into each other's territory where you really have to separate them out in your mind, but just kind of where that wealth of wellspring comes from.
Well, it sounds like a cliche, but I think the imagination is like a muscle, and the more you use it, the more it helps you, the more it provides for you. And I have a drawer full of ideas for novels and short stories that I probably will never get to. The idea comes to me, I write them down because I don't want to forget them. I put them in the drawer, but there's always a new idea. And as a consequence, you're always moving on to what is the freshest thing in your mind. Although once or twice I've gone back to that drawer, but I think it has to do with remaining very active in the exercise of your imagination and also being very engaged in the world as many ways as you possibly can and having as many interests as you possibly can. And that way you're always feeding the mind.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. If a lot of these are generated from news stories and kind of combing newspapers to generate ideas, or if they... I know you do a lot of volunteer work as well, and as you're saying that and kind of having your tentacles out into the world, I imagine that, you know, people either through living just feed you stories or you come across ideas a whole variety of ways.
They come at you in unexpected ways. I was in L.A. at a studio meeting on a film project, and when I was coming back, I was in my wife's SUV, and I wasn't in a good mood. You're generally not ever in a good mood after an executive studio meeting. And I felt like I wanted to commit homicide, and she had a deck of CDs on that were Simon and Garfunkel or Paul Simon. And I was just playing because they were there, and there was a song by Paul Simon called Patterns, and a line in the song is, "My life is made of patterns that can scarcely be controlled." And within about 10 minutes of thinking about that, I came up with an idea for a novel of a man who is born on the night his grandfather dies, and the book would open with his father in the hospital going between the expectant father's lounge and the ICU where the grandfather is dying. And the grandfather has had a stroke, can't speak, hasn't spoken for days, but suddenly sits up in bed and starts making predictions about the baby about to be born. And he predicts weight and all kind of other things, which he's correct about, as it turns out. And then he predicts 5 terrible days in this boy's life. And the first is when he's 20. Then we jump forward in the novel to the first of those days. And all of that came from listening to that song and hearing that line. Then other ones come from just moments of observation in life. I don't know if I've had one that can't come from something I saw in a newspaper, but I am working now on a series with a character named Jane Hawke, who is an FBI agent who's gone rogue, and she has turned up a very hellacious conspiracy involving an application of nanotechnology. And I will say that part of my inspiration of that was hearing things that Elon Musk said that I found really disturbing. And one of them, he looks forward to the day where we all have a neural lace in our brains to help us think better because we'll be married to computers. And my first thought was, if you've got a neural lace computer in your brain, you can be hacked and you cannot have any longer full control of yourself. And I began to get a novel out of that. So they come from everywhere, and that's what I mean by never limiting yourself to any point of view about anything, to keep your mind open to everything, because that's where the material comes from.
I've heard you've fallen a little bit in love with that character, and I wonder if that's helpful or sometimes a hindrance to kind of love your characters a little bit too much.
Well, I'm sort of known that I sometimes fall in love with the characters. Jane, I fell in love with. I tried to figure out exactly where she came from, because she's very tough. She's can absolutely do what's necessary. She is, however, has this enormous good heart, and. Actually, I came to feel that it was the women in my life that inspired me to Jane. It's been unfortunate that outside of one uncle, I never had any men in my life that were strong, important influences to teach you to do the right thing. But I had many women of that nature and some very strong ones, including my mother and most of all my wife. And so I think Jane is an amalgam of all those, and she surprises me. She does stuff that may sound unusual, but when a character comes really alive, you are not always creating them. The character starts creating themselves and will suddenly do something or say something, and you'll have to stop and say, whoa, wait a minute, that is going to have consequence, and is that really right? Would this character say that? But over all these years, I've learned if the character says it and you weren't anticipating it, then you should step back and let the character go, because they will become much more interesting for you than they would have if you exerted a kind of an iron control.
Uh-huh. I do think that there has been this misconception that horror or suspense or thriller or crime, all those kind of genres, are more plot-driven than character-driven. And I have heard you speak before and have read in interviews how important you think character is, that character is really the driving force, regardless of how much action is taking place on the page. It's all motivated by character first.
For me, it is. I don't... And for me as a reader, that has always been true. I can enjoy a book that's totally plot-driven, but I don't remember them very well, unless it's just an interesting conceit at the center of it that that you can't forget. But if the story works, it's because the people in it work, and you want to know what's going to happen to them. You want to see them get their comeuppance, or you want to see them survive, or whatever. Yeah, I always know if I'm 20 or 30 pages into a manuscript and I'm not really engaged in those characters to the extent that I ought to be. It's time to put that idea aside or reconceive the character, because otherwise I just don't think anybody's going to care enough to go forward with it.
Right. Well, so let's talk about the character of Ricochet Joe. Is this your first kind of foray into this type of Amazon Kindle book? And maybe you can kind of describe how the book works in a different way than just a print book for our listeners that haven't picked it up yet.
Well, I've written a number of novelettes. Actually, they were published by Random House as ebooks and later in other formats. But in this particular case, Amazon came to me and said, "We want to do this animation that is illustrations that actually have animated elements to them." And they tried to explain that to me, and I think I understood it fairly well. And they said, but we need a story that really will have lots of opportunities for interesting illustration. I thought about it a while and came up with the idea for Ricochet Joe. And I thought that the illustrations in it are just incredibly clever and interesting. And the illustrator, Oliver Barrett, is quite talented. When they said to me, we'd like to use this, we can give you several to choose from, but our primary favorite is this Oliver Barrett. And my first thought was, oh, the lead character of Love Story. That's what happens when you spend your life reading. You have all this useless information and connections also, but in addition to all the useful stuff. But I think he's done an incredible job, and you'll actually have to see it to understand what they're talking about, the Gullick Kindle in motion, and it's very intriguing. It's a new way to think about looking at fiction. I'm not sure it would work so well at novel length, but I think it works very well at novelette length.
Yeah, so talk about your kind of point of entry for Ricochet Joe. So it sounds like, different from other books that you've written, you had to kind of come at this through the back door of knowing that this was your task and it had to be visual. But kind of talk about the point of entry for where the idea came from. So it's very philosophical and sci-fi all at once.
Yeah, my first thought was I would like... like to take a character of, I think Joe is 19, and I wanted a character who was very sweet, very naive, and outside of the fact that he had lost his mother to cancer when he was a child, he has almost no memory of her. He has sort of skated through life. He has a grandmother who loves him, and he has at least a good relationship with his father, and he's community involved. And I was thinking of Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future, the first movie. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of some kid like that. And then what I thought would be interesting is I thought it would be interesting for the illustration of the story as well as for the writing of it, that if we start out with Joe and we like him, he's kind of fun, and something really strange happens to him that is also kind of fun in its way. And as Joe is involved in that, things gradually start taking a darker and darker and darker turn until we end up in the story where it's not a role you could see Michael J. Fox in, although he was very good in things where he didn't just play that same character. And that Joe would have gone from a guy who didn't realize, who had no capacity to see evil in the world, to a guy who not only has the capacity to see it, but for whom it has completely changed his life. And that's what I started with, and the concept that Joe just one day would suddenly touch an object and it would send him ricocheting through town to other objects, and each time he would touch one, he would name another object and be compelled to go to it, and all of this would lead him step by step to some crime in the course of being committed, but there's a bigger issue going on. So it's got this sort of sci-fi edge to it, and fun with that, but it's philosophically, as you said, it goes to darker places.
It's really wonderful. I was a philosophy major, so all your discussions of time, and I don't want to give too much about the novel away, but we're very appreciated. It was really, really fun. I wonder, I thought, and also without giving out too much away about the book, there's kind of this idea of evil embodied. And I wonder if when constructing all of your work, is it, because there's always kind of evil forces, how much do you feel like you have to develop sympathy, empathy for the evil character? You know, it's easy to identify and be empathic for the heroes. Is that more difficult for you to do for the evil beings in your book? In this one, it wasn't as necessary, but in others, it is.
You sometimes, when you're looking at a story, you have to give. No character can be. This takes me a moment to get around to, because I handle this in an unusual way, I think. If it's there's two kind of characters. Let's just say there is the evil character, who's the one who has gone to the dark side, and then there's the character who is not just evil or sociopathic, but who is literally a monster. And the monster is, I'm going to say, strangely enough, a true monster in a story is easier to make sympathetic or empathetic than a human monster in a story. The novel that probably has sold the most copies of anything I've written is a novel called Watchers. And the concept is that two creatures escape from a genetic engineering lab. And one of them is a golden retriever who has been the subject of intelligence-enhancing experiments and has human-level intelligence. Can't talk, of course, because it's still a dog. And the other thing that escaped from the lab is something of horrific nature that is designed as a battlefield weapon, a biological weapon. Let's just say a horrific soldier based on various animals. And the monster of the story hates the golden retriever because everybody in the lab loves the golden and everybody's afraid of it. And so it's a pursuit story in part, but it's a story about how each of us impacts and changes the lives of everybody we meet. And everyone in the story, there's a comment or the quote from Carl Jung people, when two people meet, it's like a chemical reaction, same as with two chemicals. If you combine two chemicals, if there's any reaction at all, both chemicals are changed, and the same is true with people. And that was something that book was interested in dealing with and exploring. But in the course of the book, I felt very much that you had to come to have some sympathy for this horrific creature that has escaped the lab, because it didn't ask to be what it is. It's sort of in the role of the Frankenstein monster, in that the sympathy in that story really should lie with the monster, not with the doctor. And she does a very subtle job in the novel of portraying that. The movies, of course, always make the monster the monster. But I found that giving a monster a human side is much easier than giving a really vicious sociopathic human character a sympathetic side. So what I tend to do with human characters who are full-on sociopathic is I don't want to glamorize them. I don't want you to say, oh, that is so interesting, that evil. So I give them an unintentional funniness. They don't realize they're foolish. But you see that there is this very foolish side to them, and that colors them in a way that trying to make them sympathetic might be dangerous. And so I color them as fools that they are unaware of being, and it makes them more dimensional, and it may even make some readers feel sorry for them that they are the way they are, but that is a different kind of, that's rather pity than it is sympathy. I don't want to create sympathy for a sociopath. Sympathy implies that you share something with the person, and so that's why you sympathize. you sympathize with their suffering. In pity, you don't share it, but you can have pity on the suffering, but you don't share that same suffering. And that's what I try to achieve in a bad character through the use of humor. I hope that didn't rattle on too long and made some sense.
No, that's really interesting. Is that done kind of through backfilling as part of your revision process, or is that organically done as you... Because so many of these books seem so carefully constructed, although it sounds like you allow your characters to surprise you and take you on their own organic adventure that you might not know about. So I'm trying to kind of balance, you know, whether you're, they call them pantsers or outliners, where in the process you allow yourself to understand or either take back the reins. Am I making any sense? Where in the process you start to outline after the story has kind of been organically written?
I never outline. I did many, many years ago, but I wrote a novel called Strangers, and I was frustrated with the whole publishing industry, which is doesn't make me unique. And I wanted to write a book they just couldn't ignore, and it turned out to be a book with an enormous cast of characters. And for the first time ever, I did no outlining or anything else. I sat down. I had maybe as many as 9 or 10 characters in different stories all over the country that came together eventually in the novel, and you found out they had all shared an experience that they were unaware of. And it was a lot of balls to keep in the air at the same time, but when I didn't do an outline, I felt freed because the outline drove me towards thinking of the story in a certain way. And when I didn't have the outline and things began to happen that were unanticipated, the story opened up in ways that an outline wouldn't have allowed. And so I stopped outlining at that point, and I've never outlined since. I tend to look at character as the starting point, but then when I'm before I even write for a day or so, and I'll have the character and a premise, but the premise has to have some sort of what I would call thematic element to it. It has to be outside of the premise or the plot point that it begins with. For example, what if dinosaurs could be recreated out of ancient DNA? That would be Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park. That would be the premise you begin with. But then in the novels I write, they have to be about something more than that to engage my interest. And so then it becomes, what is at least one of the major themes that this premise would give birth to? And as you think about what that theme is and what that core theme would be that runs through the book, in these Jane Hawk series I mentioned that I've been working on, the premise is about mind control to a degree, but the themes are about free will, how free will works, how important is it? There are people who believe we don't have will, there free will. There are people who believe we do. What would be the loss of free will if it exists, which I believe it does, then what would the loss of free will mean to the freedom of the human race? And when you have some of those themes and you start to work them, that starts shaping everything too, because the characters embody the theme. They embody, the protagonist embodies the plus side of that theme, the antagonist often the negative side, and you let them start running the story, it goes to all kind of interesting places. And so I just sit down and work. I may go through a page 10, 20, 30 times before I move on to the next page. And I inch my way through the book, sort of, I've said before, like coral reefs are built by all those millions of little calcareous skeletons of sea creatures. That's the way I put a book together.
So that when it is done, it's pretty much done.
Yeah. I have been with it so much. I work, I get up at 4 or 5 in the morning, and I often will shower and then come and work a couple few hours before my dog is ready to get up. Wow. And then I'll go back and get the dog and take her out and feed her, and then I'm back at this. So I can put in 10 hours, 11 hours a day, 6 days a week, and toward the end of the book, 7 days a week. So I get lost in the fictional world because I am there so intently. The fictional world during the writing of a book becomes almost as real, or some moments more real for me than does the world I'm living in. And so maybe that's why I end up not needing the outline, because I'm so intensely involved in the writing.
Right, right. I talk to a lot of writers who use those early morning hours when you're kind of still in that dream state, kind of still in that unreality state. I think a lot of interesting subconscious fiction stuff bubbles up in those hours. So what a good, it's hard to set your alarm for 4 o'clock. It's hard for me, but there's a lot of fertile stuff that comes out of those hours, I think.
Yeah, and well, I'm sort of in that unreality dream state most of the day.
I had heard you also give very good advice to writers about dialogue. Dialogue is something I struggle with. And I heard you say one problem with dialogue that writers may struggle with is trying to convey too much information through it rather than just doing character development or allowing readers to understand how a character talks. But put information conveyance in narrative, not in dialogue. And that has really helped me.
One of the great things about fiction, about books, as in fiction and formal books, as opposed to, say, film or TV, is on the page, in the written page, you can go internal. You can't do that in film unless you go to a voiceover, which almost everybody wants to avoid. And so... it's being able to get that character's thoughts across. There's nothing worse in fiction than what I call a talking head scene, where two people are sitting there just conveying information about the plot to each other or about other characters. It can be what goes wrong with mystery fiction sometimes. Also, when you're doing dialogue, it's one of the funnest, it's one of the most enjoyable things in writing is getting those voices right. When there's in The Whispering Room, which is the second Jane Hawk, she has a rather extended scene with a crime boss in rural, I'm trying to think what state it is. It's down on the southern border. He's a rural crime boss in the Ouachita Mountains. And he speaks with this accent, Arkansas. Speaks with this Arkansas backwoods accent. And catching that exactly right makes his dialogue not just authentic, but fun. The way he says things he says to her in this course of this conversation, they're everything that they're conveying is conveyed not boldly, but underlying much of it, underlying the way he says things. And you know she's in a threat situation, but they are sitting on a porch and rocking chairs like a couple of old friends. And it's that kind of thing in dialogue that I find absolutely wonderful, because no two characters should really talk the same, because they're as different as real people. That is one of the great challenges in writing. But I also think it's one of the things that's the most fun to do if you can find your way to get it done correctly.
Do you read it out loud to yourself, or do you read it out loud to your dog?
My dog thinks I'm strange enough without the reading aloud to her, I sometimes pause and go over it aloud just to hear the rhythm of it, because then if you do this correctly, be prepared that some people will write you and they'll just be upset with you. I just got mail, that's why it comes to mind, from somebody who said, I was an English teacher and I love your books because the language is used just wonderfully. But you have this scene in which this character keeps saying that there. And nobody should be pushing that. Well, it's this very scene, but he's speaking with this in this dialect. And it struck me as odd that this teacher of English, certainly also a teacher of literature, didn't understand that when you're inside the head of this backwoods crime boss, he's not going to talk grammatically correct. So some people will not understand, but you have to give yourself to it.
You can take the English teacher out of the book, but you can't. That's funny. God, it kills me. We're running out of time, but I wonder if there's other. You're just a fountain of advice. This is wonderful. writing not even 101. It's like writing 1001 for writers. Is there?
Well,
other
if you wanted to do this another day, we can certainly do it that way. You just let me know.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Any last minute advice we should have covered that we didn't?
All I say to is that the best advice I give to young writers is don't write what you think you should write. Don't write what somebody else thinks you should write. Don't scope the market and write what you think is going to sell. Write what really stirs your passions and is you alone, that it's not like anybody else. That's what you have to sell, is your unique voice and your unique way of seeing the world. And the more you color it according to what other people tell you you should be doing, the less success you're going to have.
I love that. I love that. Normally, this is the time in the interview where I tell people where they can find you online. However, you know, much in the David Letterman, my guest, next guest needs no introduction. That is, I believe Dean Koontz needs no introduction, where people can find him all over. But congratulations on everything. Will Joe make another appearance, or do you feel like Joe has served his function?
You know, I haven't told my agents this yet, but I think I'm going to turn Ricochet Joe into a screenplay, because the more I look at it, the more I think there's little things I could have done that I would like to do better, and the story is so visual that it would lend itself very well to that. So I may revisit him in that format, though I previously said I've given up film writing forever, given the crazy nature of Hollywood, but maybe I haven't. So.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Well, I can't wait to see Joe. I had the same thought as I was reading. I was like, this is such a visual, I don't know, you know, it's such a visual book that you can absolutely see it on the screen. And it was really fun to see it on the Kindle in motion. I hadn't encountered that before. It was. I really encourage our listeners to pick that up. It's very cool. Very cool. Dean Koontz, thank you so much for taking the time. This was wonderful.
Okay, you take care. Thank you for having me there.
We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Patrick Nathan will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you aren't awake after that interim music, you... You need more coffee. That woke me up. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We are under College Radio. Or you can always find us on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. We have direct downloads of hundreds and hundreds of shows up there, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, all kinds of stuff up there. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Patrick Nathan's short fiction and essays have appeared in Gulf Coast, Boulevard, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and elsewhere. His debut novel is out next month. It is Some Hell. It's published by Grey Wolf Press, one of my favorite presses, and we are going to chat about it this morning. Patrick, welcome.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming on. I love having writers come on before the book's release, because I feel like the conversation is fresh and unrehearsed, and I also feel like there's the book in the writer's head, and then there's the book in the world, and, you know, kind of getting digested and refracted through all these different readers' and reviewers' minds. And so I love kind of getting it on the ground floor of that. So I appreciate you coming in early to talk about this. This is great.
Oh, yeah, no problem at all.
Yeah. So why don't you take us into it? This is such a good book. Why don't you take us into Some Hell, kind of talk about... I know none of our listeners have picked it up yet because it's not out yet. So kind of take us into this world, into Colin's world, and talk about the book a little bit, your elevator pitch for the book.
Oh, man, this is always the fun part. You know, what's your book about? And just kind of stare blankly. so the kind of way I sum it up is you have Colin, who's about to turn 13, and he, you know, is kind of up against what 13-year-old boys are up against, which is, you know, their siblings, middle school, which is the worst time of anyone's life. And shortly before his 13th birthday, his dad kills himself. And then from then on, he kind of has to renegotiate his relationship with his family, especially his mother, who starts to rely on him more as an equal and a peer rather than, you know, taking care of him as a child. And the book is basically the 18 months following that suicide and the way that both Colin and his mother, Diane, negotiate that absence.
And I should tell our listeners, it's absolutely not a young adult book. I mean, when you phrase it with a teenage protagonist, I think it could lead some people down to thinking, you know, what's the difference between YA and literary fiction?
That's always been a really fun thing to negotiate from the beginning, you know, because if you start talking about it, it's like, oh, it's YA. Well, no, not really. I mean,
no.
It's, you know, I'd like to think that fiction can be refracted through a protagonist of any age. It's always hard once you get the marketing aspect in with the book. It's you know, in marketing speak in general. I recently had somebody who told me he had read the book, and he said, I'm glad I gave it a chance because the way that it was, you know, LGBT coming of age story, I normally don't read those. And I'm like, well, you know, thank you for reading it. But it's yeah, it's the joy of marketing, I guess.
Right. So talk a little bit about kind of the inspiration of the novel, kind of the point of entry. Like what was the intriguing lead line that drew you, the writer, into the book? Like, did it start with character? Did it start with...
So it kind of starts with both character and a situation, I suppose. I was 24, so this is 2008. Actually, I guess almost 24, I was 23, summer of 2008, I was trying to work on a new short story, and I was playing with the mystery trope of the, you know, the story that starts out with the body, essentially, the dead body, and like, oh, who did it? But then I was like, well, you know, just because one loves to subvert cliches, what if the body was alive? But kind of marked for death. And then I realized over time that this story also coincided with a couple other stories that I had wanted to tell and had been kind of, you know, keeping track of in my notebooks for a while. And I eventually realized that the body, so to speak, would be this teenage boy who is essentially, in a weird way, marked in a way he can't kind of get away from. And, you know, in a way, that's a lot of what growing up, especially growing up gay, is being marked in a certain way that you kind of want to escape, but eventually come to accept that you can't. I don't know.
So you let Colin, I'm trying to think of like how much mental stuff went on before you got it down on the page, or if this was all working through it while you were writing the book. Like, when did the book kind of reveal itself to you? This is the aboutness of the book. This is what I'm writing. Was
yeah.
it, you know, 200 pages in?
No. Honestly, the first sentence, with the exception of changing, okay, the first sentence, there we go, 2 days before their father shot himself, Heather foretold her brother's death, with the exception of changing 3 days to 2 days, that sentence has not changed since November of 2008.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I kind of gave myself some time and some space to figure out how the story would translate into kind of a more novelistic structure. And I kind of, you know, took notes to myself about how I could braid all these different things together. That's not to say that the first few pages of the book weren't initially written for a completely different kind of book. The book overall kind of went through two massive incarnations. Initially, it was a much simpler and much more true to that idea of like inescapable fate or whatever. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I realized that that was really boring, and I wanted to do other things with it.
What was that? So you were originally a writer of short stories, and that always seemed so daunting to me to move the brain from that, you know, kind of limited canvas of a, you know, 15 or 20 page short story to the 250, 300 page novel. It's just a different way of thinking. And I don't know if you always kind of saw yourself as essentially a novelist that was just working up to writing your first novel. But just kind of switching that mindset from short to long and all the things that means, because it's really such a different genre.
It is, and I mean, obviously it takes more time to write a novel, but I really think that short fiction is the harder one. It's the harder one to do right. Harder one to pull off. You need to do your sentences and every single word needs to do so much more work than it does in a novel. And that's not to say that you can be sloppy in a novel. Novels are much more amenable to having flaws and living with flaws than a short story.
Yeah.
A short story doesn't really get away with having flaws. That said, the transition, the part that was difficult was accepting the idea that no matter how hard you work in a day, you're nowhere near done.
Right.
Like, you can write 10,000 words in a day, which, you know, if you're really caffeinated.
You're crazy, yeah. right.
But you're still nowhere near done. This is, you know, ongoing act over years.
And do you get lost in the process of that? Like, did you get lost in the forest from the trees? Did you find yourself having to sketch out, you know, I'm always using the word outline, but did you have to sketch out kind of where you were in the book and you know, so you don't get lost from the where you've been and where you're going?
In a way, yeah. So I did use an outline for the first draft, and I shouldn't have done that. In a way, I don't know. It encouraged me to stick too rigidly to things that didn't seem organic enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm like, well, now I have to do this, so let's just jump right into it. I think the ultimate mistake, which, you know, what is a mistake? You know, it's just a way to learn. But the ultimate waste of time, I should say, that I did was in my revision process, leaping into rewriting sentences, rewriting scenes without taking the time to question if those scenes were even necessary or in the right order. If the novel should even end the way that I had it end, which is completely different from the way it ends now. When I started my second novel, let's just say, I went into it with no outline. And every day that I sat down to write, I would kind of explore in my notebook what I wanted to do that day, what needed to happen next, where people needed to go, and I would write that, and that would be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
It was kind of just a feel it out as you go. And that novel, I finished the first draft almost 2 years ago, and it's been sitting untouched in a drawer.
Wow.
And I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Who was the most difficult for you in here? Was Colin, I mean, did he come fairly organically and then you struggled with other characters? Because I always talk to authors who, the characters who are kind of too close to their heart are often the ones that are the most difficult to render, and the ones who have no relationship to them whatsoever are sometimes the easiest to see, maybe through, you know, distance, a distant perspective. And I wondered if that was your experience here, if Colin or one of the other characters was just confounding to you and you had to work on them harder, or, you know, talk about that mining of character process.
Yeah. So my initial problem with Colin, I did not make him human enough in the sense that he wasn't making enough bad, selfish, or even cruel decisions. Which, you know, came later as I, most of the early drafts of the book, Colin and Diane, his mother, are both incredibly inactive characters. They just kind of let things happen to them and get swept away. And the later drafts, I came to accept, I came to understand that they would have to do some pretty horrible things to each other, to people they love, but above all to themselves, in order to get themselves into different places. And that was really enabled by allowing myself to give them a completely different ending that I had not seen before.
Yeah, interesting. And is that just a process of writing, rewriting? Did you have kind of, I'm trying to picture kind of what your office looks like. If you have, you know, character sketches and notes about each person, or if, or is it all done kind of in the novel itself where you're just rewriting scenes over and over?
So I keep, I keep, you know, an ongoing journal, which I also use to jot notes about stuff I'm working on or ask myself questions about what I'm doing. And that's where something like, would Colin do this? Or how is Diane going to get into this situation? That's kind of where I would, I guess, troubleshoot that sort of thing.
Yeah, okay.
And then they would develop, you know, in the body of writing itself.
I like that. What would Colin do?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's totally, the it's funny, the last thing I ever did on the book, I got an email from my editor, Grey Wolf, and he was pushing me to make a few final changes, and I actually sat down with myself in my notebook and titled a new page, The Final Catechism. And I asked myself, like, is this necessary? And then I would answer it. And I would say, would Colin actually go through with this? And then I would answer it. It was kind of just a nice, liberating way to, I don't know, logically work through the most difficult questions of the book that had lingered all the way up to the end.
Yeah, yeah. Is it, how many revisions would you say this was from kind of, I mean, it sounds like it went through two massive ones, but within it itself, how many revisions would you say there was? Because it was written over the course of 8 years, right?
Yeah, the draft I handed in to Grey Wolf in March of 2016 as like the final manuscript, and, you know, obviously that's not including copy edits and proofreading and all that. But the final manuscript version was called Some Hell Draft 14.
That's good to hear. That's a very good thing for writers. Yeah, yeah. 8 years and 14 drafts, I think, is very common. And what would you say was kind of the most, either the most difficult aspect of the writing process, or something that you learned through it that when you start, you know, novel two, well, or, you know, novel, whatever it is now, because I assume you have the novels that aren't, that are in the drawer. Was there something that through that 8 year process and 14 drafts that you would do differently when you approach the next one?
Oh yeah. I mean, for one, I already
know that every single project, whether it's a novel or an essay or a story, whatever, everything has its own process. And it's kind of foolish to go into it expecting that you know how it's going to be written. Yeah. However, I do know that overall, a strategy that works for me that I did not know while I was writing the novel is distance. Hmm. That's why novel number two has been sitting in a drawer for 22 months. Mm-hmm. I want to forget as much as possible about it before I start revising it.
That is great advice. That is great advice. Yeah, because I think you can't see its problems when you're too close to it. And
And you can't be surprised by the good parts.
Yeah.
You know, I go back and read stories after 4 months of ignoring them, and I'm like, oh, I forgot about that. That's cool.
Right. Your dialogue is so great in here, and I have been saying to every author I talk to, dialogue is something I struggle with, to make it sound authentic, to make the characters sound very different from each other. To reveal their motivations, but not to have them, you know, like preaching to the reader, here's the stuff I need for you to know. I don't know if dialogue comes easy or hard to you, but if you have any tips and tricks in that regard, I'm totally open to hearing them.
Yeah, I think judging by the way that the book actually came together is to write as closely as possible to the way that you imagine these characters actually speaking, but then deleting about half of what you actually write.
Interesting. Okay.
Because you'll end up writing a lot of things like, all those little tics that people say when they speak, which on paper starts to become incredibly redundant, bogged down, nonsensical. But you also, in doing that, kind of record the natural rhythms that people use when they speak. And then when you start to delete a lot of that filler, you kind of retain that authentic core of their dialogue.
Do you read it out loud to yourself?
Oh, yeah. I'm always muttering to myself when I write scenes, especially that take place between two people.
Right. So tell me about readers for your work as well, because I'm in a writer's group, and I always feel like I and other, maybe others, because we're on a deadline usually, because we have to bring work in and I procrastinate, am showing work almost too soon when it's too raw, and then you get feedback on it, and then, you know, it takes the magic out of it. Do you share work with readers, and then at what point in the process do you do that?
So with fiction especially, I have what I call a readable draft, and it takes a long time to get there. Early in the process, it's really, really not a good thing for me, especially to share things with people, because you want to make sure that everything that they're seeing, everything that's being revealed to them, is doing the work of the story, and that they're getting the overall sensorial impression of the story. I mean, I think of fiction as much more of an impressionistic medium than a lot of other kinds of writing, where it's not necessarily something to be understood so much as felt.
Uh-huh.
And it's really easy to miss that feeling in the early drafts of something.
Yep.
And also, I try to, when I share something, I try to either ask specific questions, as in, does this character sound like a woman or a man pretending to write a woman?
Right.
You know, I don't know. I actually wrote a short story that takes place in southern Chile, in Patagonia. And I've never been there.
but I have a friend who has, and I sent her the story. I'm like, does this sound authentic? And she's like, people wouldn't say this, people wouldn't say this, but this is totally how it looks, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that was helpful.
Yeah.
But the only other rule that I have when I send something is I say, don't assume you need to bring anything to this. Assume that this is something that you're reading in a magazine or in a bound book. And then tell me what you think. Because in our writing workshop culture, people feel like unless they contribute something, unless they bring all kinds of information and ideas and views and suggestions to a story, that they're not doing work.
Yeah, right.
So people come up with things to say. People put themselves into the story.
Right. That is
and,
so true. That's right.
Right, and it leads to just a kind of homogenizing way of writing fiction. And I'm not saying that all workshops do that. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not going to go on the whole anti-MFA argument. But
yeah,
you really got to know what to pick up and what to leave.
Exactly. We're out of time, but I want to definitely leave listeners with ways to find you, because this book is incredible. The book is Some Hell. The guest is Patrick Nathan. It's published by Grey Wolf, and it's out next month. It's out, is it like February 18th?
February 20th.
20th, okay. And you're doing a book tour, and you have a website.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the best way
to
find
PatrickNathan.com.
Oh, perfect. PatrickNathan.com. I stalked you on Facebook, so people can find you on Facebook. And I assume you're going to have updates up there about where you're going to be and how we can find you.
Yes, Facebook, Twitter, at Patrick Nathan. Those are the two best ways.
Awesome. People can stalk you much like I have.
They can.
Patrick Nathan, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Nathan. That's all the time we have for today. The book is Some Hell. Watch for it next month. It's a really, really wonderful read. That is all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day, and stay tuned for more awesome programming on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.